Hey everybody, Brian Dunn here, and welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. This episode is Patrick Michael Finn reading his original short story, The War in the Rack, at Spillers number 3 on February 1st, 2016. Enjoy.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, we had this little workshop. Brian mentioned it earlier, where we all got together and workshopped our stories. Everyone read out loud, and then you know everyone else could offer gentle criticisms, things like that, compliments, say what was working, what wasn't. This gentleman read his story. The first time I heard about this guy was from Jake Friedman in Four Chambers, over there in the corner with the books. He was such a fanboy of this guy, of this particular writer, that he was like, he just said, this is true. he was like, man, we went to this thing once, and he was there, and we were like sort of talking and stuff, and then he was like, do you need a ride home? And Jake was like all gaga about it, and he like got in the car, and he's like, he drove me home once. Jake was very excited about this, and I was like, settle down, man, settle down. I hadn't met the particular writer we're talking about yet. So then we went to the workshop, and he showed up. We're making small talk. We're all sitting around making jokes, waiting for everybody to arrive. And we went around the table. Everybody read their stories. Everybody's fantastic. You've heard all the stories. Are they not great? Always the bait for applause. So we finally get to this last gentleman, and he reads his story, and everyone's holding up copies of the story, and they're all looking at it, and he finishes his story, and we all just sit there and look at our pages for a minute, and then just kind of set them down on the table and look a little dazed. And I think Troy was the first one to say it. He leaned over and just kind of looked up all of a sudden and went, well, that was just fantastic. And what we're supposed to do with this workshop is critique each other's stories. Nobody really came up with a great criticism. We actually spent about the next 10 minutes just picking apart little tiny details that we loved about this story, just lavishing him with praise. And I am thrilled to introduce Patrick Michael Finn.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming out tonight on a blustery, cold Monday night. And thanks to Robert and Brian and the Crescent Ballroom for putting this all together and hosting us. I thought, since this is a Phoenix venue, I'd read a Phoenix story. I live out in Gilbert and in the deep East Valley. And I don't get out to the big city that much. So this is a real big thrill to be out here with y'all tonight. So I'm going to give you some Gilbert hospitality with a Phoenix story. The story's called The War in the Rack. The boy's father had been home from the war in the rack for 6 months, but he still wore his dog tags and yellow soldier T-shirts and puffy soldier pants tucked down into his big black boots, and he buzzed down his hair soldier short with clippers in the backyard every day. Even just before they got into the truck and drove all the way to Phoenix. And it didn't bother the boy one bit because he wanted all the other people, the people waiting like the boy and his father in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines to get tickets at windows in the shade, and then all the people waiting in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 miles, 9 lines to get into the park, wanted all of them to see the brave man his father was, how his father had fought in the war in the rack. And once they finally got their tickets in the shade at the window, his father gave the boy his and said, now don't lose it. And though the boy was still a year too young to read, he pinched both ends of the ticket and held it to his face, squinting, and knew letters well enough to connect the A and the other A and the D and the S that made the words Arizona and Diamondbacks. His father told him, come on, and the boy's squinting eyes returned to the glass buildings that gianted over them, shining in the heat. The boy had never seen this or any other city before, and it had gradually started to frighten him as they neared it on the freeway at the end of the long drive all the way from Apache Junction in the truck. And the buildings rose and got bigger the closer they got. And now, in the middle of them and walking through crowds there for the game, he felt a quiet terror that choked his breath as he followed his father away from the baseball park through the people that pushed past them both. First his father, then against him roughly. Then his father reached back for the boy's hand and took him across the street and into a dark, loud, crowded bar, where the boy watched his father break the promise he'd made to the boy's mother that morning just before they pulled out of the yard. The promise draining from the day as his father finished the beer in one big swallow, then put the empty glass down on the bar and nodded for a new one. And 25 years later, the boy will know the same powerless slack in the pull of alcohol when he opens and guzzles back the tall bud in two drowning lifts behind a Mesa liquor store on a dead avenue that runs through the end of the city and into the dreadful desert the night his own wife and boy of 5 years leave him for good, forever, and just short of forgiveness. He will finally understand what happened to his long-dead father that afternoon at the game, the day he ruined their lives to set in motion a pattern of his mother's wretched choices that she chased across the states of Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, California, Nevada, all the tattooed and cheaply jeweled men who lurked in casinos and pawn shops with lean and leering ways for whom the woman had a limitless passion. Their gold teeth glinting when they smiled and when they seethed, their quick, greasy money and even quicker fists, their sins all far more diabolical than the deep, brief catalog of faults his father had collected by the end of his short life. The boy felt small, squeezed between the big men and women in the loud, dark bar. The only darkness he knew was his bedroom at night, which was quiet except for the coyotes yipping in the distance sometimes. He wasn't afraid of them anymore. One night, not long after his father got home from the war in the rack, the boy sat up in bed, crying a little because there sounded like so many of them, and they sounded close. His father peeked into his bedroom and whispered, "What's the matter?" "The coyotes," the boy said. He pointed up at the window. "They sound like they're right out there in the yard." His father sat on the edge of his bed and crossed his arms and looked at the window and made a face of listening hard. "I hear them," he said. "You're right. But you know which ones are making all that noise?" The boy shook his head. "The pups, the hungry pups. They're just making all that noise because they're waiting for their food. Just like you used to cry when you were a baby and wanted to eat. Pups ain't nothing to be scared of, okay?" "Okay." His father got up and leaned over him and pulled his blankets up to his chin and kissed his head and told him night and left the room. And the boy fell asleep thinking about the hungry pups and hoping they got their food soon. Then he had a dream about keeping one in his room and feeding him the cheese that came in the mail. The boy's quiet terror pumped away in his chest. Having finished his second beer and having nodded for a third, his father finally smiled for the first time that day, the way he always smiled after he drank beer, which by now the child didn't see as something happy, but as a sign that his father's quiet would quit and get loud in the house, the same way it was loud in the bar. So loud he had to say, "What?" three times until he understood what his father was trying to tell him, that it was time to go watch the baseball game. He followed his father outside, and the sidewalks weren't as crowded as they were before, but the sunlight was so strong that he squinted, then stopped, then opened his eyes but could only look at the blacktop of the street. He got shoved by an older boy who called him retard, and when he looked up, he saw that his father was far ahead, and for a second he didn't want to run to catch up, because the way his father slouched and dragged his big black boots made the pride he'd felt earlier go away and made him wish they just stayed at home to play war games on the television. They both lied about not playing when his mother came home from work at Walgreens. When he did catch up, his father glanced at him and smiled and said, "They canceled the game. The pitcher got sick." And the boy wished this was true, but knew that his father was only teasing, and his shoulders got tight for the loud laugh that came next. And then his father said, "Aw, just kidding," and messed up his hair. His father bought a big can of beer before they found their seats. And when they did, all the people in the row stood at attention because they could see that his father was still brave. And this made the boy happy until his father tripped and some white foam splashed on a man whose chubby face got angry. And then the boy knew that the only reason the people were standing was to make room for them to get to their seats. And the boy's cheeks burned while his father said to the angry-faced man, "I'm sorry, buddy. God, I'm sorry." And the man looked down at the boy, and his chubby, angry face turned into the way the boy felt inside. "Forget about it," he told the boy's father. It was the biggest television the boy had ever seen. And he wondered how many men it took to get it up so high, and he wondered how many nails it took to hold it. Sometimes the television showed the men on the grass, sometimes cartoons of hot dogs playing baseball against French fries, and sometimes it showed other people in the seats, mostly wild kids making faces and waving their arms. Then his father would get loud and clap his hands, but the boy knew there was nothing to cheer for, that the people sitting around them didn't like all the noise he was making. And he knew his father would want to go buy another beer, and that they'd have to squeeze past all the standing people again. So he tried to distract him with questions. Did your daddy take you to baseball games when you were little? Nah, there weren't no baseball teams in New Mexico. Just cactuses and Jesus people. Jesus people, he yelled, then laughed. Who's that man? What man? The boy was pointing at the man in the black mask who stood behind the man holding the bat. That one. I don't know what man you're talking about. The man wearing the black hat with the mask. Oh, the umpire. He calls the strikes, balls, tells players who's safe and who's out. But the boy didn't understand. His father looked at him. His eyes were red. Then he finished the last of the beer and squeezed the can and set it on the ground and scratched his yellow whiskers and said, he's the man who tells everyone who's right and who's wrong. Like the police. There's always somebody standing around waiting to tell you what's right and what's wrong. Umpires, cops, judges, lieutenants, women, wives, and doctors. Come on, he said, and stood. When they passed the angry-faced man, he stopped his father and said, listen, man, maybe you've had enough, okay? What do you mean? You plan on driving that child home? The boy waited for his father to answer, but he just looked at the man for a time, the boy's shoulders getting tighter and his face burning hotter and his wanting to just go home. His father finally said, I planned on minding my own business. And then his father raised a finger and swaying a little, pointed it close to the man's face and said, so why don't you plan on minding your own? His father walked backwards, still dragging his big black boots all the way to the end of the row, pointing to the man the whole time. Something was wrong with his father's card. The big can of beer was waiting on the counter for his father to take it, but the man who just put it there said, decline your card, sir. Run it again. Sorry, sir, declined. The man took the beer off the counter and put it back in the glass refrigerator he'd taken it from, and his father grabbed for it and said, wait, 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 wait. No, sir, no way. His father said, well, shit, shit, and he slouched away from the counter and scratched his head and looked up at the ceiling and then opened his wallet and stared into it so hard and for so long that it looked like he was going to try to climb into it. I want to go home, the boy said. I want to go home. At the cash machine, his father jabbed his pointing finger at the numbers, then waited. He said, shit. He punched the buttons again, waited. He said, shit again, louder. Then he slapped the side of the machine and turned and fell onto the man who'd been waiting behind him. And the man shoved his father, and the boy said, Daddy. And his father punched the man in the stomach. And then two policemen in helmets ran over and grabbed his father. And the boy called out his name again, his voice breaking. Either a child devours time, or time devours a childhood. His sponsor, a black man named Leonard from Port Arthur, Texas, who'd been sober for almost 30 years, and spoke through an electric box he held to his throat so that every sentence buzzed out sadly robotic, often reminded him to remember that hurt younger version of himself he carried inside like a woman with child. He'd say, that child is angry. That child is hurt, scared, and it's that very child who yells at your wife. And he'd yelled at his wife for the last time that morning when she told him not to put that much peanut butter on their son's sandwich. Then you make his goddamn lunch. Jesus Christ. Later, he tearfully begged for her to stay. He said, but I've quit drinking for 3 months, please. No. He didn't blame her. He wouldn't have wanted to live with himself either. He was hopeless. Still, he went to get his chip that night, 90 meetings in 90 days, not a drop. There were about 50 people seated at 10 round tables inside the Living Waters Fellowship Church Recreation Room, and they'd all stood to applaud, some whistling, as Leonard put the chip in his hand and embraced him. He smiled and said, "Thank you, Leonard," wishing the old man had given him a pistol. What had kept old Leonard sober, so he'd explained, was taking care of his own wounded boy that lived inside, holding him, rocking him, telling him the grown man he was now was strong enough to take care of all the awfulness the child hadn't been able to protect himself from. And while he understood the concept, he could never quite figure out how to do it. Leonard said, "Write him a letter. Tell him what you'd wanted to hear." And when that didn't work, Leonard said, "Close your eyes and imagine his face, his angry face, his frightened face, and pick him up and kiss him." Then Leonard said, "Imagine him sitting at a table alone in a room. Now imagine what he has to say when you walk in." But none of it worked. He craved drink hourly, slept very little, and then he'd spend entire weekends in bed, from Friday after dinner until Monday morning. And when his wife asked him to wake up, he'd roar, "You have no idea what I've been through. No idea." The only reason he kept the chip at all that night was so that his wife would know he'd followed through on at least one promise when they found him. And then as soon as he left the meeting, he broke the promise behind the liquor store, drowning the tall bud in two long tilts, squeezing the can empty, then gasping, then wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. And in breaking the promise, his head alight with drunk, empty death, he understood that his father, like himself, simply had no strength to heal whatever little injured being lived inside him, and didn't have the capacity to live with what he realized wasn't a whole child at all, but a black, empty mouth screaming ceaselessly. He'd left no note in the house because no one would be there to find it. He'd actually tossed the hose and rags and towels in the back of his truck before he left for the meeting. And before he got there, while there was still light, he scouted and found the right spot, a mile beyond the guardrail fixed with three yellow diamonds where the avenue ended. He held the steering wheel for 15 minutes in his terror, breathing deeply, before he let his hands fall into his lap as the hose whispered a lengthy and senseless confession into his left ear. A few thoughts passed through his other ear without fixation. He coughed once. He closed his eyes. He only noticed that the hose seemed to get louder, hissing, but he didn't open his eyes, and his mind emptied of any source of reasoning that would bridge even one synapse of curiosity. But the hiss escalated to a scream, and that scream came from inside, from a little black mouth. And, like the ring around the moon, a face formed around the mouth, and that face was his face. And from the face grew a little body that stood watching two, then four, then six policemen wrestle unsuccessfully to the ground his drunken father, who kept standing, swinging, the child screaming, "Stop it, stop it," his mind white and blank, unable to reach who is right and who is wrong, seeing, but not knowing why, the policemen beat his father with black sticks, and when his father stood again, they sprayed his face, and when his blinded father stood yet again, swinging his fists, they shot electric spider webs into him, all six of them, and he buzzed as loud as the clippers he used to keep his hair soldier short. And finally he fell and didn't get up, shaking wildly, a yellow bleeding blur in black boots, until one of them said, "All right, all right." But his father didn't open his eyes, only his mouth. And a sound the boy had never heard before fluttered from his father's throat like a quail without any music. And one of them said, "Aw, God damn it, was that his death rattle?" "His what?" said another. And they all turned and beheld the child, red-faced but no longer screaming. A boy who didn't have the alcohol or cigarettes or weed or pills or cocaine to comfort him. A boy who only had strength, which he finally extended to himself some 25 years later. "The rack," he whispered through the hose. His eyes flashed open. Then he reached for the key and killed the ignition. Thank you.
That was Patrick Michael Finn reading his short story, The War in the Rack, at Spillers No. 3 at Crescent Ballroom on February 1st, 2016. For all Spillers After Show podcast episodes, including exclusive interviews with the writers, please go to spillersaftershow.com. For more information on Spillers, Phoenix, Arizona's premier short fiction storytelling event, go to spillers.net.